I think the cool thing for me was that when I saw kiteboarding, I saw it was a way to ride a board, you know, whether you were on a surfboard or a wakeboard.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Basics Podcast. Today should be a super fun episode because we're sitting down with a big homie of mine, Andre Phillip. If you guys have been kiting for a little while, you might know who he is. If you're new to kiting, you may have no idea who he is, but he's been a huge mentor of mine and kind of one of the most influential kiteboarders in the past, you know, 10, 15 years. So we're just going to kind of jump into his story a bit and just get to learn a little bit about someone who's been, you know, devoting their life to kiting for like over 20 years. Okay, guys, so before we get too deep into today's podcast episode with Andre Phillip, I just want to let you guys know about the chance to come out and shred in paradise with myself and Megan in beautiful Antigua and Barbuda. Basically, we've organized these Antigua kite charters from late November until about June, July, where you guys get to come out and tap into paradise for a week on board a 40-foot catamaran. So if that sounds like something you're into, take a second to check out jakekelsick.com/kiteboardingtrips, and everything you need to know about these trips is on that website. So again, jakekelsick.com/kiteboardingtrips. Yeah, so you don't want to miss out on this opportunity because we don't have that much space, and yeah, it's kind of like one of those once-in-a-lifetime dream trips where you get to kind of kite in a place that not everyone knows about and not that many people have gotten to see. So yeah, check it out, and now we'll jump into the episode with the legend and Tona co-founder, Andre Phillip. Let's go. What's up, man? Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, man, all good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, dude, this has been something I've been trying to make happen for a long time, where we always kind of like just miss each other.
Yep, yep. So I'm pretty glad that we finally got a chance to lock it down.
Yeah, bro. I usually like to start off these episodes by just kind of jumping into your backstory. You know, I touched on it a little bit. You've been kiting for 20 years. So, you know, how did that start? How did, you know, younger Andre Phillip get into kiting 20 years ago? And, you know, what was that whole process like?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we need to rewind the clock even further back. I grew up in a small neighborhood in Antigua, and luckily I had a bunch of people my age kind of in the same zone, you know. So from early days, I had like a little rat pack that I used to run with. And, you know, you'd find us like riding our BMXs and playing basketball, cricket. You name it, you know, we were doing it together. We'd ride down to the cliffs and jump off and go swimming, whatever, just gallivant together. We had a real nice rat pack. And from early days, I guess we all kind of fell in love with water sports. And one summer, we all kind of learned how to windsurf. And that was probably like the main thing that drew us to the ocean. So from then on, we did it all, you know, we BMX, cliff jumping, windsurfing, and that led to wakeboarding, to surfing, and then that was it for me. I was just like locked into water sports from then on. So yeah, from early days, that was kind of the scene for us. And then in about, on, I think it was 2019 or 1999, because we're 2019 yeah. Now. 1999, I traveled to Maui with a friend to go windsurfing. And that was actually the first time that I had ever seen kitesurfing. And it was Lou and Elliot who had caught my eye, because they were the guys out there kind of just like throwing these crazy tricks and getting big air. And I was just like blown away, because for me, it was kind of like all of the sports I already loved, you know, like wakeboarding, windsurfing, surfing, all kind of mishmash into one sport. And I was just like blown away, because I'm like, okay, I need to learn this.
Yeah. You
know, it's so awesome. So I came back to Antigua, and shortly after that, a friend, Eli, had traded some windsurf gear for kite gear. And So he was kind of like the first guy to be kiting in Antigua, and I saw him here. I was like, oh, dude, like, you got to teach me, you know? So he kind of gave me this, like, quick throw you in the deep end lesson, and I was hooked from day one.
Yeah. That's crazy, man. So big ups to Eli. Way back in the day, he was the first dude to kind of bring it over. And because when you saw it in Maui, you never got to try it. You just saw it.
No, right. I never got to try. I mean, that was back in the day. It was like, you know.
No schools, nothing. Just right. Like somebody like out there doing it,
exactly.
Figuring it out.
You know, they had a few hardcore Maui guys who were obviously dabbling in the sport. And yeah, I mean, I didn't really have much access to gear at the time, you know, so... It was pretty cool that Eli was learning at the time, or he could do it. And so I had that kind of outlet to give it a try and, you know, get hooked. Yeah. And then after that, it was like, okay, saving up, you know, try to get my first kite.
Yeah.
You know, never look back.
Yeah, so that's super interesting hearing the very beginnings. But, you know, you did get super hooked and then eventually managed to build a whole life kind of around kiting. So what was the process like from, you know, learning it, getting the chance to actually, you know, get your hands wet, to then being able to like travel, compete a little bit, and then start, you know, growing into being, you know, the big kiteboarder that you were?
I mean, the hook went in deep. My first actually lesson was like, Eli was like, okay, you know, basically you put it to neutral and that's like your safe zone. You know, you dive it, you get going. And when you want to come back, you fly it back the other way. That was kind of like my lesson, right? So he literally like handed the kite, stuck the board on my feet, and I just dove it and took off, you know, crashed, managed to get the board back on. Same thing, coming back to the beach, like flying out of control. And I literally like just went straight up the beach, like, face through the sand, you know, just trying to keep his kite in the sky, because I'm like, I can't wreck this guy's kite day one because I can't afford that, right? Yeah. Anyway, so like basically the hook went deep, and I, from then, that day forward, I was basically saving for a kite. I think a few months later, I had bought a kite. And so it just kind of, I added kiteboarding to my, you know, my hobbies of getting in the ocean, shredding with the homies, and it was kind of my light wind solution to those days when you couldn't surf or you couldn't windsurf. Mm. I just got on the water a lot. I was just doing it for fun. It wasn't like I wanted to be a pro or anything. Mm-hmm. I was just having a lot of fun with the homies. And then Kitesurf Antigua came along. And so I started kind of working at the school and teaching kiting. And that was a bit of an outlet to get more time on the water and, you know, get paid.
Yeah.
And just continue to kind of do what I like doing and being around the ocean more, you know. So I did that for a couple of years. And I guess I was... at the same time sharpening my skills, and the owner at the time, Alex, he was like, man, you should go and like compete, you know, like,
yeah.
And I was just kind of like, well, yeah, it sounds like a good idea on paper, but
how am I going
to
do that?
How am I going to do that? Like, I can't afford to go out and travel the world and compete. So anyways, he was kind of like, okay, well, I'll help you out, you know? And, we'll see how it goes, you know. So we organized to go to my first contest in St. Martin. So it was kind of like a regional.
Close by, not too far.
Yeah, exactly. And my biggest rival there actually was Sky Solbach, who also ended up, you know, going pro and whatnot. But he was like one of the best in the whole Caribbean, you know? So he was kind of like the guy to beat. And from Bonaire. And I went across there and managed to squeak my way into a win. And so basically I came back and Alex was like, wow, that's like amazing, you know, like let's
keep it going.
Let's keep it going, you know. So I think the next event I did was in Cabarete. And that was like now a World Cup event, right?
So yeah. So much higher caliber,
yeah,
of riders.
Way higher like... caliber. And so anyways, you know, went over there. And as soon as I landed down and saw the guys, I was just like, whoa, this is a whole another level to, you know, what I had been doing or any of the guys in St. Martin. But it was cool, you know, it was cool to see like this was all the top guys in the world who yeah. come together to like, you know, compete against each other. And so, yeah, I think I finished really poorly. Mm-hmm. you know, just pretty much got my ass handed to me. And but learned a lot, you know. It was cool because I could see, oh, this is where I need to be if I wanted to like
yeah.
compete on a global scale, you know.
Yeah.
So came back and I was like dusted up myself off, you know, but I had a lot of homework to do, which was cool. And I had a nice eye opener as to like what could be done. Yeah, so I just came back home and didn't think too much of it because I still wasn't in this mindset of, oh, I'm going to be mm-hmm. like, you know, this mm-hmm. pro or anything really. I was like, oh, you know, like I'm happy to come back and like sharp, like test myself and push myself and try again, mm-hmm. see what happens. So yeah, I just kind of did that back and forth for a bit and hit some events until I started to get like top of the rankings, you know, like mingling with the guys in the top of the game. And then I got more support from like kite brands. And yeah, one thing kind of led to the next. And then all of a sudden I was in the scene and being able to, I guess, sustainably carry on competing and mm-hmm. and doing that. So yeah, I mean,
yeah, pretty cool, man. It's cool just to kind of, you know, track back and figure out, you know, because for me, I was a young kid, kind of, I saw kind of maybe later on after that,
right?
But you know, it's just cool hearing, you know, the steps of, you know, getting to where you actually were able to keep going, you know.
Yeah, I mean, real big ups to Alex, because I think if it wasn't for him giving me that opportunity to just
yeah.
give it a try and
just to get over the fence and actually, you know,
yeah,
get your feet wet,
then I probably wouldn't have.
Crazy. Yeah, that's all it takes, though, that one chance, you know, that this opens up everything, and then yeah. you know, who knows what's to come.
Yeah, exactly. You know, once you work hard at it, then sky can be the limit.
Yeah. And yeah, then it's pretty interesting though, because you know, you did compete for a little while, but I feel like you didn't compete for that long. You kind of, after getting some traction and stuff, you kind of pivoted into doing something quite different, which was like, you know, focusing on media coverage and getting magazine articles, traveling, doing stuff like that, right? Like, why did you end up going that down that route and not just, you know, focusing on being the best kiteboarder, competing all the time and just being 100% focused on competition? Because you were like, back then, you were like one of the only guys who was doing something that was different to, you know, the top guys, because top guys were basically all competing, right?
Yeah, and then more or less.
You kind of just transitioned into this thing and it kind of became more of your full-time thing and you weren't competing as much. You were kind of just becoming like the face of kiteboarding in a sense. One of the people that were most known within kiteboarding just from magazine articles, videos, stuff like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, funnily enough, I never liked the competition scene.
Mm.
Like, I loved the family, because on tour, you know, you have the same people kind of traveling the world and coming together to compete and whatnot. And so there was a bit of a family aspect to it, but I never liked basically like going out in a box and being judged mm-hmm. and having like 10 minutes or whatever. I never liked that aspect of it. And a lot of people, when I say that, they're like, what? Like, that doesn't make any sense, you know?
Yeah.
But for some reason, it didn't gel well with me.
Yeah.
Obviously, for me, I knew that it was an outlet to, you could go to your sponsors and be like, look, I won this event. Like,
yeah.
There's
I'm worth something
there.
Now, yeah.
So it's kind of clean cut. So I knew that it was my best chance at, like, continuing this lifestyle.
Yeah.
So the thing is, as soon as I kind of got my foot in the door with my sponsors, I was like, guys, I don't really like competing, you know? And luckily, you know, my boss, Pete Cabrini at the time, he was cool with that. I think he kind of gelled with that anyways, because I have a feeling that he was similar to me in that sense, you know, that yes, he competed against his peers. And that's how it is for me. Like, you know, that rat pack that I always ran with, we would always push each other against each other. But if you put us in a box, it was different.
Changed the whole vibe, yeah.
So when I went to Pete and I'm like, hey, you know, I would really like to get off the scene, off the whole contest scene, and kind of go down a different road, you know, and work more on video parts and work closer with the magazines just to portray kiteboarding in a good light, and maybe help inspire some people to be like, whoa, that's pretty cool. Like, you mm-hmm. know, like, I'd like to try that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bit of a driving force for me to detach. But at the same time, the whole contest scene was, you know, the judging was a bit weird. You know, we always had this seesaw between the riders who, you know, we were the ones out there kind of pushing ourselves and I guess in a sense pushing kiteboarding in a certain way. And then you had the judges who there was a seesaw to where the judges kind of thought, oh, well, this is where things needed to go, or this mm-hmm. is harder than that, so it should be judged or scored this way. So there was this weird, like, you know.
Yeah, back and forth of people. I guess it's early days too, so like it was still the sport was really trying to figure out where we're going, you know?
Yeah, exactly, you know. And so I just kind of wanted to step away from that. So at the same time, I was spending a lot more time in Maui and just got tight with the Maui crew, you know, like Moe, Mauricio, Elliot, Lou, all the guys that were kind of just on the ground there, out of the contest scene.
Yeah.
And pushing themselves.
Yeah.
And like I gravitated towards that. So basically that's another reason that kind of pulled me away, I think.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely the right move, though, because, you know, a lot of people may not know any of the history, but, like, you know, you were kind of one of the first guys really pushing, you know, kind of what's known today as, like, park riding, hitting rails, building features, riding in boots versus straps. Like, you know, that was definitely a game changer. For a while, it was kind of you and your crew were the only guys riding boots, only guys ever seen hitting kickers, hitting rails and stuff like that. And I guess you're saying that kind of sparked out of seeing these other guys and then kind of just figuring out stuff that you like doing and going down that path, and you had the support to kind of continuously, like, you know, make stuff, document stuff, and it boomed into like a super big thing, because for a while you were kind of like the most printed kiteboarder ever, you know, like you had sick cover shots, you had like all these magazine articles, you had so much coverage in a mag. Yeah. I think if we went through the history and went through it, you probably had the most coverage, like, in that time frame, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely.
It was like crazy, you know, and it's pretty amazing to see that, because you took a different route and like you really went hard at it, and it freaking made you into, I think, one of the most well-known kiters at that time.
Yeah, I mean, you
and
know,
like, was that like, you know, like, I just want to figure out, like, how come you decided to push the whole, you know, riding boots, the whole park style, because at the time, you know, that did not exist, and, you know, you guys were documenting and you'd see it in magazines and stuff, but it still wasn't really a thing, you know, whereas these days, you know, a lot of people ride boots, there are a few kite parks around the world, but really a way more riders actually kiteboard in boots now, which back in the day didn't exist,
right?
You know,
yeah. I mean, back in the day it was definitely a handful of guys. I think the cool thing for me was that when I saw kiteboarding, I saw it was a way to ride a board, you know, whether you were on a surfboard or a wakeboard. So like for me, it was like a board sport,
mm-hmm.
and having a bit of a wakeboard background, it was just kind of the logical thing to be riding a board with boots, where you're just way more locked in, way more attached. But at that time, you know, there were a handful of guys riding that way who were influenced by snowboarding and wakeboarding and skateboarding and surfing. And so there was like a pocket in Maui, a pocket in Hatteras. You had a crew down in Australia and probably like a few more people kind of like sprinkled around the world, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess when I linked up with the Maui guys, I like found my home, kind of, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And because we were all like-minded, you know, we all had a board sports background and we all just wanted to kind of bring that to kiting, you know? And so, yeah, we love to build stuff and shred it and and just push our limits, really. So that's just what we were doing. We weren't, I mean, obviously, because we were sponsored, you kind of have to do work and try and get magazine coverage. So we did have relationships with the magazines and you know, we were working with guys who would be shooting video and like, you know, try and capture the best part of what we were doing so that we could just share it with other people. Because we were so stoked on it that we just wanted other people to like...
to get a taste of what you guys...
stoke, yeah. You know, because that's the thing about kiteboarding. It's like, it's so cool. It's so fun that once that hook goes in, like, it's hard not to like it. You know, it's hard not to love it, hard not to be stoked. So... yeah.
Definitely, yeah. And if you guys actually want to like see a bit about what we're talking about, there's a video called Autofocus. I think you just search on YouTube and like a little ripped copy will pop up and it will really kind of just show you, you know, all the stuff that we're talking about. All the rails are like handmade, you know. I don't think you'd built too much stuff before that stuff. You kind of just figured it out and, you know.
Pretty much. I mean, we were just doing, making it up as we went along, you know. We're like dream something up and build it and then go shred it.
And I remember those days so vividly because for me it was crazy because I was a young kid who just got into kiting and I got to see you and your crew, you know, Moego, Mauricio, we were all those guys like when they were at the house and you guys were just building rails and shooting every single day. Mm-hmm. And it was just like crazy for me because I'd be like sitting here talking to you and then like pick up a magazine and like your photos in the magazine as well. And like you guys would just leave your kite gear set up all day because you're just like, what? Like, how is this even possible? How is this a thing? Like this group of guys are able to like do this all the time. Like, what?
Yeah,
that's the thing. Super crazy. And yeah, one thing I want to talk about too is like, how did you like go about, because you said you built a bit of relationships with mags and stuff like that, but like you know, you did a great job at getting coverage. And was that kind of just something that kind of happened, or were you just always very active at building relationships with mags, building relationships with specific photographers and videographers? Was that something you really focused on, or was that something that you kind of just happened and gelled with and it kind of just naturally happened? Because your crew ended up, you know, you guys produced some of the best kiteboarding content at that time and, you know, still, if you check out Autofocus today, it still lives on, you know? So yeah, I guess just any tips for like people wanting to like start getting coverage and stuff like that, like how did you actually get to the point where you had this, I think, machine that was kind of just, it was just a wave that was flowing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, definitely sparking up relationships with the media guys, that's a big deal, you know. I ended up having like a really solid relationship with Tracy and Elliot. And they're like a media team, you know.
Yep.
Elliot was one of the best in kiteboarding and did so much for the sport, but ended up blowing his ACL, and that's when he started ACL Productions.
Yep.
And Tracy is an amazing photographer. And so they live on Maui. We ended up becoming great friends. And so I ended up working really closely with them most of the time. I think I worked the most with that crew. But also, you know, just developing relationships with people in the media world definitely goes a long way. And hang out more with people that you really gel with, you know, like that's at least what I did.
Mm.
You know, like there were a few photographers that I really like. I like their style. I like their attitude. And we got along really well. So we would plan trips together, you know, and try and think about fun, cool shots and or maybe article ideas. And then, you know, from getting images that are print worthy, you start developing these relationships with the magazines, you know?
So,
it's just to keep that relationship going. And
yeah. And I guess back then too, there weren't that many people doing a good job at like creating media as well. So you probably became like a good friend of the mag because you had sick articles, you had sick photos. So like it was a win-win.
Yeah, for sure. You know? I think that we cared a lot about how the sport was portrayed. You know, like we wouldn't be sending in a photo that was like a missed grab or just yeah. like something that was kooky looking just because like, yeah. oh, we got a shot. Like we wanted the sport to look good. And also I think out of respect for the other board sports that came before,
yeah.
there was definitely this thing of like, oh, you know, kiteboarding.
It's a bit wonky.
You know, it's like,
yeah.
there was a bit of a kooky image out there, and some of the other board sports or the people involved in them were just kind of like, oh, you know, kiteboarding's kind of kooky or whatever. But
yep.
but we knew that it wasn't, you know, and there was so much coolness going on. You know, at the end of the day, it doesn't even matter if you're being kooky, like if you're having fun, right?
Yeah.
But we really wanted to make sure that, you know, people were seeing it in its best light. So we spent a lot of time, like, you know, planning shots and trying to get the goods.
Yeah.
And that's what we would give to the mag. So they were stoked. It was, you know, it was a good relationship.
Yeah. Win-win, man.
I mean, we didn't have social media back then.
Yep.
So you know, everything was like way more calculated. You couldn't just like do something and splash it out.
Yeah.
You know, you had to like contact the mag.
Yeah, go through the system. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's cool though. You guys definitely did a good job. You know, I think, you know, today I think the whole boots movement, the whole Parks thing, like you guys actually played a humongous role in that actually becoming a thing, you know, because now they have events like the Triple S. I guess we can kind of touch a little bit on that, you know, because you were again one of the first guys to kind of be a part of that event. And now these days, that's kind of one of the biggest kiteboarding events. You know, there's big money on the line. There's a whole sick park. There's a good crew of riders. And like you again were kind of a part of that seed that was planted way back in the day. So I guess we can kind of like talk about that a little bit, like Triple S, like what it is and kind of what it was when you first got into it compared to what it is now.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it's like it's kind of one of the most prestigious events now, I would say. You know, there's big money on the line, and the best park guys are going there or want to go there
mm-hmm.
to, you know, shine.
Yeah, yeah.
But it started off as basically a backyard jam, you know. There was no money on the line for
yeah.
years, actually. It was more a bragging rights thing. You know,
yep.
it was like, oh, you know.
He's the one. He's
yeah,
the one.
Yeah,
he got
he's
it.
He's the one.
He's got
you
it.
Know, whatever. But it started off as a backyard jam. Basically, you know, it was a real kind of by the riders, for the riders type event. And it's funny because, you know, other events can end up politics get in the way and sponsors and this and that. And judges, and,
mm-hmm.
and this was just very roots when it started off. So it was judged by the riders, and there were no like structured heats or anything like that. You know, it's just basically you set the park up, everybody shreds for as
jam
much
session,
or
yeah.
as you want, and you know, in the end of it all, they crown the winners, and
yeah.
everybody, you know. High fives. And
yeah. So crazy thinking about that. Because, yeah, like literally it was like the riders would actually vote, like everyone who was actually riding. Because I got to be a part of the event like pretty early on when that was kind of still the format.
Mm-hmm.
It was so interesting because, you know, everyone shares. And then at the end of the day, like you as a rider, you actually vote for like who you thought was like killing it at whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And that's like when it was really for the love and like everyone was just stoked. Because it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to just vote for myself. You know, it's more like you actually cared about like the event, cared about what was happening and, you know.
Yeah, and I think as a rider, you also knew, you know, you could relate because you could potentially do those tricks or maybe
yeah.
you couldn't. And so you knew the real value of what people were doing.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't so far-fetched, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was a cool time because, yeah, we all did it for the love. It
yeah.
was 100%. You know, bragging rights.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how's it feel now? Because like now that event has major traction and, you know, like it's solid and I think it's going to be around for a long time and continue to just morph into being even a better event. So how does it feel to actually be like, you know, you definitely, you and your crew, Jason Steele, like all those guys, you guys were pushing that for a long time until it got enough traction to be what it is now. So, you know,
Yeah. Pretty no, I mean, it's definitely really cool to see.
Yeah.
It's cool to see that that side of the sport has grown so much to where, you know, it's a bit more mainstream.
Yeah.
And, yeah, more people are kind of just getting involved in that side of the sport and really pushing the limits. Like, it's crazy what people are doing these days. And, yeah, it's going to be cool to see what's going to be happening in the next 10 years, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Like the level, every year the level goes up. I mean, even back in the day when I was doing the event a lot, you could see sometimes during a session, like it would turn into a feeding frenzy. It would be like, oh, so-and-so just landed something, and you'd just be like, nah. And you would just...
one up.
You would just be pushing your limit that much harder. So like in a session, you could see the actual bar being raised.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which is, it's crazy cool to see that that's happening.
Yeah, man, it's sick. And I think it's just cool because it's going to like open up just access again, you know? Because now I think access is still kind of restricted. There's still not that many parks to go and ride, but I think over time that's going to grow. I think now Hood River is kind of the only place that has a public park that, you know, anyone can kind of come and ride. So it's cool. That's going to, I think, allow the sport to just, you know, kids will kind of get in and kind of go straight to that. They won't really be going any other way, they'll have access to it. So it's just going to allow things to continue to level up and level up, you know?
Exactly. I agree. I think in the future we'll see parks all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's just cool to see that kiteboarding has been splitting off into so many different disciplines and just growing and maturing in their own ways, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, cool, bro. It's awesome just to kind of hear, you know, all that history, boo. We're dropping lots of history right now. But one thing I kind of want to talk about, like kind of specifically for you too, is like, how did you actually make money as a kiteboarder? Because that's the question like everyone always, I think it's still kind of a mystery, you know, some people don't really get it. So was most of your money from direct sponsorship or was it from magazine articles or was it from like more places than that? Or was it, you know, just kind of what was, you know, I don't want to know exactly how much money you were making, but just kind of how, like what were the ways of making money as a kiteboarder back then?
Yeah, I mean, I was basically a sponsored rider, you know, so I was paid to use the product of my sponsors and have it appear in video, magazine media, that kind of thing, and be promoting it wherever I go. So that's kind of how I made money. some people were kind of going down the road of like what is it called?
Drug dealing? I don't know. What are we talking about?
No. You know what, like when you, if you get a photo incentive.
Oh yeah, photo incentives, yeah. So each, more photos meant more money.
Right, so how they got paid was directly in relation to what coverage they got.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's basically how everyone back then was making money. It's either you got a salary for promoting the brand, or you got paid per product placement in a magazine, in a video. There weren't a lot of people making money. The other way to make money really was to win contests.
Yep.
And just stack the prize money.
Yep.
You know, but if you didn't already have a sponsor that was paying for you to get there, then that prize money going straight to plane tickets and hotel and rent car, you know.
Yeah.
So for many years, like all of the money that I made went straight back into traveling. But, you know, as the years went on, it just kind of grew and starting making better dollars. And
you know,
I could continue to kind of do what I enjoyed doing the most.
Yeah. It's cool, dude. It's just interesting, you know. That's good. That's solid feedback, you know, because I think a lot of people just sometimes don't have any idea how it's even possible, you know.
Yeah.
And I think these days it's kind of changed again a little bit because, I mean, it's still kind of the same thing, but I think there's kind of a chance to be able to create more opportunities in a sense because there are different ways you can like bring value to a brand, you know, as far as just showing that you have traction or you have an audience or you can help the brand be in front of X amount of people, which back then didn't exist. So it was like magazine articles, was the thing, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much. That or winning comps. That was the only way to, you know, get any sort of traction and show that you have any value.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, as you say, these days, there's a lot more outlets, I think. It's still along the same lines of bringing awareness to the brands, because at the end of the day, it is a form of marketing.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
Cool, bro. And yeah, I guess we're going to kind of transition into kind of an extension of that now. I want to talk a little bit about Tona, the kite brand, which you and Derek started, as well as your other friend, Adam. Like, let's just kind of talk a little bit about the brand. You know, why did you start a brand? Because I remember back in the day, very vividly, you know, you were having a great career as a full-time kiteboarder, sponsored, doing your thing, and just, you know, everything was cool. But then you decided to kind of start your own brand. And this is a question I've seen people ask me as well. You know, why would you start your own brand when there are already these brands that already exist and they're big and they've been around forever, whatever, whatever. You know, what made you wanted to start your own thing after, you know, already being, you know, worked yourself up with building a relationship with someone for so long?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's several reasons. Mm. You know, I did work with Cabrina for like 12 years, you know.
Yeah.
And it was cool. It was a great run. But I think that, yeah, maybe wanting more freedom, wanting to pour like a lot of the things that I've learned over all the years into products that I would really love to stand behind. Kind of get stepping away from the corporate
machine, basically. Yeah.
You know, where the corporate world is answering to a lot of different things. Whereas, like, if you start off, you have a small brand, you know, you can kind of do things your way.
Yep.
But yeah, the history with Derek and myself, you know, Derek actually used to live in Antigua, and he has a crazy history of water sports all his life too, and shaping boards for like over like 30 years now.
So crazy. That's longer than I've been alive, bro.
You know, it's kind of cool. We've been friends for a long time. I mean, he's probably known me since I was tiny. He's also lived in Hawaii. So there's like a lot of parallel roads for both of us. And one day he was down here and we were talking and he was like, you know, what do you think about like starting a brand, you know? And I had been thinking, it's always kind of been in the back of my mind for the same reasons I just mentioned. But it was a little bit more of a reality that, yeah, we could start something pretty cool because, like, you know.
Yeah, you got the knowledge, you know.
We've got the skill sets. And to be able to just pour all that energy and knowledge into, yeah, something that you stand behind, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so we basically, Tona was born, you know?
Yeah, it exists, you know? If you want to, like, check out kind of what we're talking about, you can go to tonalife.com and check out the gear. Because right now, we basically got three boards in the lineup, and we just launched a brand new kite called the Stratus. So it's pretty exciting to just see, you know, the gear start to expand, and it's kind of cool to be able to just be kind of almost a one-stop shop where you can come and get your board and kite and go and tap into the shred and, like, you know, awesome feeling gear and awesome looking gear. I think we've been doing a great job at just the actual visual aspect of our gear because our build's been good for a while. But like the visuals, if you put our gear in a shop against other people's stuff, there's a high chance you're going to stop and kind of look at our stuff because it kind of definitely has a lot of, I think, Caribbean flavor infused into it. So
yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, as well as the way things feel. Like, because that's been a big deal for me, like always coming up. My gear didn't matter what I was riding, you know, whether it's a BMX or
anything. It had to be right.
It had to feel right. It had to feel tight. You know, and if I jumped on someone's gear that was like a little bit loose here or like something a bit, you know, not straight, like it would really annoy the hell out of me. So myself, Derek, we've always been these tinkerers who would, you know, make sure that everything's tight, test a lot. And so that's really important, was to build gear that it's almost like you forget about it because
Yeah.
It feels so good. Yeah. And you can just worry about like enjoying the ride and enjoying that connection between you and the elements.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we would like to pour a lot of energy into making sure the gear feels good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we've been doing a good job so far. Because even myself, when I kind of switched from the board I was riding way back in the day to switch to pop, it was exactly what you said. Like straight away, like boom, I'm comfy on the board. I can just ride. Because usually whenever you switch gear, it takes a little while to get used to it. You know, whatever, something's different. Like not saying anything's wrong with the gear, but it's just different. Whereas when I first went to the pop, I was like, yeah, this is sick. Straight to like enjoying the session, you know. And I've heard that from other people who've like kind of tried the kite and the joyride. It's kind of, you kind of have that one touch feel, which is great. You know, that's kind of, I think, what you want out of products that you're putting out into the world, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely.
So yeah, it's cool. And I guess next question is like, what was the transition like from, you know, being just pro rider, living the dream, just having fun basically all the time, right? That was the job, to actually now having a business and then having to deal with the whole back end of, you know, a business operation. Because you and Derek are kind of the main guys in charge, you know, dealing with all that stuff. I'm kind of lucky to be able to like kind of be focusing on the promo stuff. But yeah, what was the transition like from rider to kind of, I guess, business owner?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was definitely very interesting, because before I just had to focus on just go ride, get attention to the brands and,
yep.
And it was pretty simple,
yeah.
You know, whereas when you get involved behind the scenes in a brand, you know, like, especially being an owner, you kind of have to like wear a bunch of hats.
Mm-hmm.
But it's cool. It's been a fun process. Just you know, getting my hands dirty and getting involved with different aspects of the brand. Yeah, you know, I don't get on the water as much as before, because that was all I had to do, right? So
yeah.
I spend more time behind the scenes, you know, like testing stuff. You know, communicating,
yep.
On the computer, yeah. Whatever it might be, you know. So I think both Derek and I wear a lot of different hats.
Definitely.
For the brand. And yeah, no, but it's cool. It's been a great process, and I'm stoked that I made the switch and I'm able to pour all this energy into something that, you know, you really believe in. And yeah, it's cool.
Definitely, dude. And I think it's super cool just to see product come to life, you know. When you hear ideas, talk about it, you get prototypes, and then like you have like something like that, but it's like the finished product.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, more than you ever hoped it could be. So
yeah,
I think
yeah,
that's a very fulfilling, like even with the kite too, that was a big one, you know, when we went from just making boards to making kite, like, cool, that sounds exciting, but ooh, that's going to be a big one. That's a tricky one, you know, because there's a whole, it's completely different to just making a board.
Exactly. Yeah.
But again, I think we nailed it with the Stratus. Like, looks good, feels good. And like, it's a great kind of all around kite. Which for me was kind of like, oh, it's like, you know,
yeah.
We did it. I didn't know if we were going to be able to pull it off for the first kite, but it came out, you know, amazing. So,
yeah,
it's cool.
That's the thing. We've got all this experience, you know, so it's really to just get your head down and work on each product until you feel happy with it and feel
yeah.
right that it's ready to kind of go out into the world, you know. So,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, we have that. Flexibility to not have to rush anything, you know. We don't have like the end of every year we have to like,
you know, revamp everything. Brand new gear, it's the same, but it's brand new. So
yeah, you know. So I think it's nice just being a smaller brand and not like super corporate, and you know, not having all of these crunch times and deadlines. Obviously, we make deadlines for ourselves, but it's we're more flexible.
Yeah,
and so we can really work on stuff until we're happy, and then.
Yeah, and then
get
put it out. Yeah, pretty freaking sick, Bruce. So yeah, guys, again, if you want to check out what we're talking about, go to tonalife.com. Check out all the gear. I think you guys will be stoked in what you see. So yeah, I guess we can kind of roll into the next question. So, you know, I guess what keeps you coming back to kiteboarding? Because obviously now you got a big kite brand, so obviously that's one big pull, but you still enjoy the shred. I see, you know, when you do get out, you're still stoked to be out on the water. And you know, what keeps you coming back? Is it just the freedom of being able to roam around? Or I guess, you know, maybe if this has been shredding so long, it's just like been, you know, it's become a part of you. But, you know, after you've been kiting for so long, what makes you still want to go out and actually tap into the shred?
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. at the end of the day, I think that's what's the draw for me. At the bottom line, it's fun.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what brings me back every time. I think the fact that it's now a lot more diverse, you know, back in the day, I would only be doing freestyle, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would just be, you go out and you jump, you do tricks, which was really cool, you know, and an outlet to really push your limits and whatnot. But now there's like surfing and foiling, racing, big air,
yeah,
and whatnot. You know, I kind of focus more on, you know, going and throwing some tricks down or getting on a surfboard out in the waves or going foiling. But yeah, I mean, it's just fun to get out with the homies, explore a bit on the foil.
Oh yeah.
Go and smash some lips,
yep,
on a surfboard.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the full aspect of like being out in nature, sharing it with your friends, you know, laughs, good times.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like it's just fun.
Yeah. That's it, man. It's just always cool just to hear, you know, people's reasons. It's all kind of similar. But yeah, I think that's the cool thing about kiting is it has a lot of variety. You know, if you're into going, sending it to the moon, cool, bro, go do that. If you want to go roam to places on the foil that you've never been, like even for me, when I started foiling, living in Antigua, it was like mind-blowing because there's so many sick spots that you would never be able to get to on a twin tip because they're just too far away. So you need a boat, and it's just a whole different operation. But on foil, you can get up to spots and like just go way, way, like all around the island. And like, that's amazing, you know. And without kiting, without foiling, you would never have that experience, you know. So that's kind of the magical thing about kiteboarding. It's kind of like having a superpower when you figure it out. You have this freedom to kind of go and do what you want, and gives you a reason to kind of be outside and start tapping into all these little gems that are just sitting there until you show up, you know.
Yeah, And as you just said, freedom. I think freedom is a big thing too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's just you, your kite, your board, the wind, the water.
Yeah.
You really are free to like push yourself in whichever way, you know, if you want to just cruise or if you want to jump or, you know, you want to go here, you want to go there. Like,
yeah. Totally
freedom,
up to you.
Like, you know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Freaking awesome, man. So yeah, after all these years of kiting, you know, you've been able to travel a lot. You've been to so many sick places, but I think we're going to keep it to the Caribbean. What's kind of like, what is your, I guess, top two places to kite in the Caribbean?
Top two.
Like if you could only go to two places.
Yeah.
For a freaking epic kite session, where would you go?
Home is always pretty sweet, but yep. I guess that can't.
Dude, that can count. That can count. That it represents. That's one gone.
Home, I mean, yeah, we have a few spots that have, you know, that I really love.
Yeah.
I
agree. I think Antigua is kind of one of the underrated spots. Like, it's actually a really amazing place for kiting, but it's not mainstream, you know?
No.
It's not really like a mecca or like it's not super busy, which I think is also kind of a nice thing, but.
Yeah,
beautiful locations.
I mean, if you don't want to end up in a super crowded place, then here is a good spot to come to.
Yeah.
Especially if you have a boat, then it just really opens up a lot. But yeah, I mean, home is sweet. It's warm. The winds are steady. And the water's clear.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
You know, as far as Caribbean goes, it's like kind of has everything you would want to need, you know? And we got variety too, which I like. Because some spots, they have like one thing,
right?
Whereas here we have a bit of everything, you know, which is kind of nice. You got some flat water, you got some real flat pool looking water, got a little bit of waves every now and again, like, so it's cool to have some variety, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
Spot number two, that's it.
Spot number two would have to be a toss up.
Ooh.
Between DR and the Grenadines. I say DR because like I spent so many years going there, you know, it's close to us.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's the wild, wild west. Like anything goes. I mean, you know, like literally you name it, it could happen there.
Yeah.
But it's consistent, like during summer, like it's just so windy.
It's like a wind farm. Yeah.
Windy. And you can have glassy flat water, you can have waves. It's crowded these days and it's not as cheap as it used to be. But the nightlife is great if you're into that. There's some nice restaurants and whatnot. It's all like compressed into a small zone, so you have everything you need within walking distance.
Yeah,
and kiting distance. So that's definitely up there.
Definitely.
So I guess, I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's between there and the Grenadines.
Yeah, the Grenadines is sweet, but you kind of got to be in a boat and it's a different experience. It's beautiful. It's paradise. It's where you go to kind of, again, similar to here, get away from people and just tap into like magical sessions. But the DR is definitely a spot. I mean, a lot of people probably already know about it, but it's definitely an experience. You got to go there because it's like, it's a kiteboarding mecca, you know? Like for me, even coming from here, like kiting exists, but it's not like a mecca. Whereas when you go there, like in that little section, Cabarete, it's like everyone eats, sleeps and breathes kiting.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
You know?
You have to watch out because somebody might land on you.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, you can get away from that and you can travel a little bit up and down the coast and literally be, you know, kiting by yourself as well. So, yeah, I would say I would put up there high up on the list, you know, if you want to go on a kite vacation and just score and get everything you need within, you know, a couple of miles, then you're good to go.
Yeah, true that. So Antigua, the DR. And, you know, maybe the Grenadines, if you can slip that in. Those are the kind of top spots in the Caribbean. Cool, dude. So kind of rounding up here. But, you know, your life's very, I guess, based around kiteboarding. But what do you get up to when you're not kiting? What's life like outside of kiteboarding? When you're not building the band, when you're not actually underwater shredding, what are you into?
If I'm not kiting, I'm probably surfing if there's waves. But if not, you know, I just like to hang with the crew. And we're probably, you know, like at the beach, boating.
Yeah, still out in nature.
Yeah, just hanging out outdoors. Like to be outdoors. I love capturing moments, so I spend a lot of time behind the camera.
Yep.
You probably wouldn't believe it, but I garden.
Oh, shit. Yeah, you guys got to see, like, around here, bro, there's freaking plants everywhere.
Yeah, like, kind of got into growing, like, you know, like, tomatoes and lettuce shit, and whatnot. Bro. And it just kind of, like, went... So, yeah, I spent, like, quite a lot of time. That's kind of a good place to zen out to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool, bro. That's awesome. You know, it's just always interesting just to hear, you know, because everyone in their life, they have something they really do, but it's cool to have a bit of, you know, other things that just kind of get your mind off things and allow you to kind of tap into that zen for a little bit and just, you know, take a break from what you're always, you know, focused on. So
exactly. I think it's good to switch it up from time to time, you know, like if you just have your head down doing one thing all the time.
Burnout.
Yeah, you know, so.
Cool, bro. Well, yeah. I think that's kind of pretty much it, bro. I appreciate you kind of taking the time. It was cool to kind of just document some of that history and, you know, talk about stuff that you probably haven't talked about in a long, long time.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a long time. You know, it's crazy when you look back and think you've been kiting for 20 years.
That's insane.
I mean, it just doesn't seem right. But yeah, it's been a while. So it's kind of cool to reminisce a little bit.
Definitely, bro. Appreciate you taking the time. If you want to check out myself or Andre, best place to kind of reach out is probably on Instagram, just at Andre Phillip. He's got sick photos. He's like big inspiration for me as far as photography goes. He's definitely, I think, picked up a lot of tips over the years
as far as
how to capture moments. So yeah, head over to Instagram, check him out, hit him up. And then you can also follow me also on Instagram and YouTube, just Jake Kelsick. Appreciate you guys tuning in. And I know I haven't put out a podcast in a long time, but this is kind of the one that's going to reboot it. I want to try and do at least 2 podcasts a month, maybe more, but I want to make sure I do at least 2 a month. Alrighty, guys. So yeah, that sums up today's episode of the Basics Podcast. Big, big thanks for tuning in. Really excited to kind of reboot the podcast and just kind of figure out ways to keep sharing the stuff, keep keeping people inspired, keep keeping myself inspired. Basically, that's kind of why I do these podcasts, to get to jam out with other inspirational people and also kind of collect this info and package it up so it kind of keeps, or at least hopefully, makes people think about things a little bit differently and really kind of keep that dream alive. So yeah, big thanks for tuning in. Make sure you leave it a review if you are listening on Spotify or iTunes. Like it, share it. Let's get the word out and kind of keep doing fun, awesome stuff. Big thanks for tuning in, guys, and I'll see you soon in another episode of the Basics Podcast. Peace up and big ups.
Big ups.